Okay, so we're in Acts chapters 23 and 24. Last week we talked a bit about how self-preservation and survival can cause a prejudice, a blanket prejudice against peoples, and as we saw that play out in all these different groups, and trying to make sure that we're conscious of that when we do that, even if it's not just people, but certain things we just kind of avoid because it's better for us to just categorize this whole categorize a whole group as bad, to avoid it rather. Just trying to be conscious of that. So that was kind of the thrust of what we talked about. But we saw how things are starting to heat up for Paul. And here it's getting into really, he's getting into really hot water. But we'll see how he handles it. There's a lot of fascinating and dense history happening in these two chapters. Not very obvious spiritual lessons, but much like Esther, there's bound to be some things hidden underneath. But this is a passage that has a lot of people, a lot of players, a lot of interesting things going on. And I want to get through it as much as possible so I can make one particular point at the end. And it has to do with this visual, and basically what I showed you with the kids here a second ago, which is basically chaos, craziness, all these things going on, but then through the middle of it, a single line thread, unwavering, going right through the middle. So just picture that. So just like a cloud of dust and debris and things flying around and hitting each other, and all the while, through the middle of it, there's this steady, slow passage through. Got it? Okay. All right, so let's go ahead and get into it. Acts 23:1. Paul, looking intently at the council, pause. Paul had been away from Jerusalem for how many years? Several years. I think it may have been about 20. It was a while. And some of the men on the council he would have recognized, as he would have served with when he was there before, serving with these men. And some he would not have recognized. They were new folks, or folks who were around him in orbit but weren't serving on the Sanhedrin. Several former disciples had become now members of the council who had learned from him. The gentleman, Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was a friend of Nicodemus and who respected the teachings of Yeshua, he was on the Sanhedrin, a Pharisee. Shimon ben Gamliel, the son of Paul's esteemed teacher, Rabbi Gamliel II, was now president. These are Pharisees we're talking about here. So he was now looking at a body of men who he had relationships with, who knew him from the past, but now he was in a position of having to defend and stand before them. So this was new, and he'd been away for a while. Okay, so when you think of him looking intently at the council, he is looking at the eyes of the people he knows, and he's looking at them. He knows what's about to come. He's sizing them up. He's also looking at the people the men he doesn't know, or maybe has heard of, or maybe he had a passing familiarity with them in the past. He's looking at them intently. He's like, okay. There's a scene from a movie. I can't remember. I think it's Watchmen, where what's his name? I can't remember. He's this little guy. He's one of the protagonists. He gets captured and he's in prison. And all these guys in there have it out for him. And they want to attack him, but he attacks back and he looks at all of them and he goes, "You think I'm stuck in here with you? No, you're stuck in here with me." You know? So I can picture this kind of attitude where Paul's like, "Okay, all right. You ready for this, guys?
Are you ready?
I'm ready. I was born ready. Okay. He said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." In other words, he's saying, "I have remained Torah observant. I am the same man today that served alongside you years ago. Nothing has changed. I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him, basically the bailiff, to smack him on the mouth. Yeah, that's funny. Right? Can you imagine Judge Judy, you know? All of a sudden the bailiff just walks over there and just smacks the defendant on the mouth. Like what? Yeah, Monty Python skit. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law order me to be struck?" Whitewashed wall is actually a good picture here. What do you do to something when you whitewash it? You're basically making it look good on the outside, but it's dirty on the inside. You're just kind of just doing a slapdash job of cleaning something up. It's not really clean. It's just... it appears clean.
They yes, would whitewash tombs.
Yes, they would whitewash tombs.
People mm-hmm. would recognize them and stay far away from mm-hmm. them so they would not contract ritual right. unfitness for being able to enter the tabernacle, enter the temple. And especially for a pilgrimage festival, for mm-hmm. that to happen, they're barred.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. So they would whitewash the wall. It was clean on the outside. It was an indicator of something. It communicated something, but it said there's death inside, right? So this, Paul is saying you are dead inside. You look good on the outside, but you're dead inside, right? This is quite a statement. Also, Paul was appalled at this, rightly so, having sat in this esteemed body in the past. He knew how this should have gone. But it wasn't starting out to go as it used to. Particularly because he hadn't been charged with anything yet. So this wasn't a formal gathering of the council. He hadn't been charged with anything. And the violence was not befitting this esteemed body. So he was just taken aback, shocked. And I would probably not have done any better. I may have done worse in how I respond to that kind of treatment in that moment, right? So he was actually being measured by my account, by my estimate.
Is he even a legitimate high priest? Is he even of the lineage of Aaron? Because during Roman occupation, the high priesthood was up for bid.
Exactly.
And it was not. It was sometimes they weren't even lineage.
Yeah. So that's
bitter.
Yeah. So my next point is that Paul likely didn't even know who the high priest was. He didn't. This was an informal gathering, so the high priest would not have been wearing his formal garb. Hey. The high priest wouldn't have been in his formal attire, so he would have looked at this council and not seen, "Oh, there's the high priest." That wouldn't have happened. Think about this too. In the 420 plus year history of the Sanhedrin, there were 300 high priests in 420 years. Subtract from that the 80 years of one, the 40 years of another, the 10 years of a third, and 11 years of a fourth. And the average tenure of a high priest for the 296 that remained was 6 months, the average tenure of a high priest.
Why did they cycle so quickly?
They were occupied.
They were appointed by governors to this seat. And the Sadducees were they were about appeasing Roman rule. The Sadducees were, and so they had set themselves up to be the ones who were chosen by the government to sit in these positions, right? So, with that said, wondering why Paul would even say this, he didn't know who it was. He couldn't have known because the rotation of high priests was so, you know, every 6 months or so, like they just didn't last long. So it could have been any one of them up there. So that's something to consider. He'd been away from Jerusalem for a while. Jonathan ben Anas had recently been assassinated by Felix. So this was last week. We talked about how Jerusalem was on edge. There was just some real nasty stuff going on. So Ananias' immediate predecessor had been assassinated, and that's what allowed him to come back into office because he had actually been the high priest before. And again, it was an informal gathering, so it was called by a Roman commander, right? So Claudius Lysias was the one who said, hey, please come together. So there's a lot of reasons why Paul would not have known or recognized who the high priest was. Interestingly, too, Ananias was not remembered kindly in the Talmud nor in Josephus' writing. He was fat, a hoarder of money, and he was nicknamed the disciple of pot roast. Yeah. But he was still the high priest. Okay? And this is interesting. When we talk about spiritual authority, and we've talked about it in the past, all authority comes from God. It doesn't matter if the person in authority over you is the disciple of pot roast, or if he is Gamaliel or Paul or whoever. That is God's authority that individual is exercising, and you obey it, you submit to it as if it is from God. Now, are you obedient to it? That's another question. Obedience is conditional. Submission is absolute when it comes to spiritual authority. So here, even though he is a despicable figure, we see Paul, what he does next. Someone who is standing by him says, verse 4, do you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Right? So instantly he's like, oh, I was wrong. I was totally wrong. Even though what he did was reprehensible. He's like, no, I was wrong. I know that more was happening here, but in my mind, as you know, I like to imagine things in scenes from movies, whatever. So, and how quickly this all happened. It's like he comes in, someone smacks him. He says, oh, you whitewashed wall. And then it's one of those moments where someone is talking about someone, and then they're right behind him, and the character goes, he's right behind me, isn't he? Like, okay, oh, hi, yeah, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, right? So it's like this embarrassing moment. And then as we see in the next verse, Paul, perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, which wasn't new to him, he knew that that's just what the makeup was, Paul began crying out to the council, brethren, I'm a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. So he says something something is done reprehensible to him. He strikes back with a epithet. He's instantly knocked down. He looks around and goes, resurrection of the dead, and they all fight each other. And he's like, oh, okay. Right, well, they didn't believe. But he's finding it out. He's like, oh, how can I distract everyone from the mistake I made? Oh, resurrection of the dead. And they're like, ah, they all fight each other. And he's like over there trying to get his cuffs off. He's like, oh, whatever. No, that's not what happened. But anyway, so something interesting what he says here. So Luke is likely leaving out the bulk of his speech. Because later on, when the Lord speaks to him, he says in verse 11, as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem. So somewhere in here, he had solemnly witnessed to the cause of Yeshua. But Luke skips over that and goes right to the end where he says to the body, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. And then the uproar happens. So there's some stuff that Luke doesn't include here. Something else interesting, of course, to note is that he says, does he say I was a Pharisee? He says, I am a Pharisee. I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. If we're to believe what a lot of believers think, and that Paul had renounced anything about his identity, whether it was his Pharisaic identity, his Jewish identity, if that were the case, he perjured himself here by saying, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. Being a Pharisee is not a genetic. It's not what's the word? It's a hereditary. Thank you. It's not hereditary. You just join it. You join it, and then you can leave it. He did not leave it. And it's also interesting to note that he was a good Torah observant Jew of the Pharisees and of the way. So he was a Pharisee and a follower of Yeshua. They did not conflict being those. Okay, so moving on, verse 7. As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. I have a handout here, Rebecca, if you'll just take one and pass it down. I'm not going to get into it, but I want you to take that home. This is a kind of a good explanation of the difference, the main differences between the Pharisees and Sadducees. And interestingly, at the bottom of this handout, which all of you watching, you don't have access to, I apologize, but let me actually go to it and read this part for you, because it's very interesting. So the Sadducees, as we've said, they don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And this is based on a misunderstanding of a teaching by one of the last of the great assembly. So I'll just read this part at the bottom. The Sadducees' belief in no resurrection was based on a distorted understanding of a teaching in one of the last living esteemed teachers of the great assembly. This was in the 3rd century BC. Antigonus of Socho taught his disciples a good lesson. He said, "Do not be like servants who serve their master expecting to receive a reward. Be like servants who serve their master without expecting to receive a reward." Okay? Simple enough. Do good whether or not you're going to get a reward. Serve. That was the lesson. What did his disciple Tzadok, who is where they get the name Sadducees, the Tzadokim, is from, they are of those of Tzadok. Right? His disciple Tzadok, after whom the Sadducees get their name, misunderstood and came to the conclusion that there is no reward. There's no afterlife, resurrection, reward, or punishment. They took a lesson that, on the face of it, most rational thinking people would be like, okay, what Antigonus is saying is serve without the expectation of getting a reward. He's not saying there is no reward. But Tzadok misunderstood and came to the conclusion there's no afterlife. And that belief carried on for hundreds of years and led to a body of people, a body of Jewish people who didn't believe in a resurrection. Did Antigonus of Socho intend for that to be understood that way? I certainly hope not. I don't think so. Not on the face of it. That doesn't seem like that would have been the lesson he was trying to teach. Anyway, just wanted to give you some background into why it is the Sadducees came to that belief. Okay, back to the text. a Pharisee, as we can see, a Pharisee could believe in Yeshua and still be a Pharisee. And the reason I give this handout is because if you look at what a Pharisee is all about, it lines up. It shares more in common with people who are believers in Yeshua than not. Right? The description of the Sadducees, though, no. You cannot continue to be a Sadducee once you come to faith in Yeshua. There's a lot about being a Sadducee that you have to renounce. You have to give up and throw away. Not so with the Pharisees. So, interesting. Moving on, verse 9. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him." Do you know what else the Sadducees don't believe in? Spirits or angels. So they're also just like, they're jabbing, like, Well, maybe it was a spirit or angel. What do you think about that, Ananias? You know, right? There's just more and more conflict and division. This brings me to, we should recall what Gamaliel said back in Acts 5. Do you remember what Gamaliel said about how they should be treating these followers of Yeshua? Do you remember?
Be very, very careful.
Yep.
There's been wannabe messiahs for a long, long time. They come, they go.
Uh-huh.
And
if this
man was the Messiah, you do not want to be on the wrong side of God.
Right. Yep. Leave them alone.
Leave them alone.
If this is of God, if this is not of God, it'll be overthrown. If it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow it. Okay? So, I imagine that Gamaliel's son, who is now the president, he probably remembered these words, and he would have tried to hold on to that sentiment. In any case, they're not paying attention to Gamaliel's warning from way back then. They're trying to do something, trying to do harm to this movement, under the pretext of arresting and dealing with Paul, and it's not going well for them.
Tim, you are seeing a microcosm within this group of leadership that is one of the major reasons why the temple was destroyed. It was baseless hatred. Sinat of Jew against Jew. These are the leaders.
Yeah.
This is the religious leadership of the country. These are their judges also.
Mm-hmm.
And they're at each
it's tearing them apart.
Throats.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent point. This baseless hatred, I heard someone else call it something else, and I was like, it was baseless hatred, baseless hatred. It was unwarranted division, whatever the words they use. This was an evangelical, whatever. It was just like, it's like, it's the same thing. It's like,
Israel today.
Yeah, it's happening in Israel. Right. That may be where I heard it, was this commentary on that. But yeah, this is baseless hatred. This is the same person, the same Paul who has ever been, is coming forth before this body. They're not listening to the words of Gamaliel. Let's say, leave him alone. You poke at this at your own risk. And it's tearing them apart. Yeah, good point. Moving on, verse 10. And as great dissension was developing, the commander, and this is Claudius Lysias, this is the commander of the Fortress Antonius, which is built onto the temple, right? This is an important role. He's an important dude. And so he's personally taking an interest in this. He was the one who saw Paul and dragged him out of the mob that was attacking him in the last chapter. He has a very much vested interest in making sure this is dealt with peacefully, because there's a holy day coming up, and his job is on the line. Maybe his life is on the line. He wants to make sure there's peace and order, right? So the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring them into the barracks. Okay, put yourself in his shoes. He doesn't speak or understand Hebrew. Okay? He is, as a soldier, as a commander, what is he doing? Just, let's say he's in the bleachers watching this, right? What is he watching for and listening for? If you don't know what they're saying, you're looking for what? Emotions. You're listening for tone and intensity. You're looking at body language. You're trying to, because you don't know what the words they're saying, you're looking at everybody, paying attention to it like intently. I can imagine it's exhausting to have to do that without the benefit of understanding the words that are being spoken, right? So he is sitting there on the edge of his seat, reading the body language, trying to figure out when he has to go in and deal with it and when not to. Sweating, I'm sure. Verse 11, but on the night, he did discern, he took him out and took him to the barracks, right? So at one point he was just like, nope, okay, go in, grab him and took him away. Okay, but on the night immediately following, this is verse 11, the Lord spoke at his side, or stood at his side, and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." Again, this is an indication that what Paul had said was a greater length than what we read here in the earlier part of this. He spoke more. He made his case about the cause of Messiah and witnessed solemnly. And then at the end, dropped the bomb, you know.
Is this the second time he's having a visitation by Yeshua?
Is it?
Is this Paul, right?
Yeah.
So it says the Lord stood at his side when he's in the barracks. This is cool. This kind of reminds me of the road to Damascus.
Well, this also begs the question, did this happen more frequently that Luke did not know about?
Well, we only know what Luke tells us in writing.
Right. We only know what Luke chose to share with us in writing.
I hope that something, because this is the odd thing about Paul, he wasn't one of the original disciples.
Right. Right.
You know, he wasn't the original. He has a very unique role that differentiates him from everybody else.
Yeah.
I just wonder if this is the second time. And it's pretty cool because he's basically telling him, "Hey, dude, I'm proud of you, buddy.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a good job.
I'm with you."
He's also telling him
bad things.
Well, no, he's saying to him, your wish to go to Rome will be fulfilled, but it's going to be like this. You might have thought you were going to go and be a traveling minister. That would have been better. That would have been nicer for you. But no. How you're going to do in Rome is how you've done right now. Like, this is the type, and you will do it again there. So Paul is realizing, this was practice. This was practice for what was going to happen in Rome. Okay. So Yeshua was encouraging him, but also giving him a heads up of what was to come. Okay. Verse 12. When it was day, 42-ish Jews, it says the Jews, but there we know from later on in the passage, it was about 40, the next verse actually, about 40, so we'll say 42. 42 Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. So the reason they did this is because acquittal was almost certain. Even though he hadn't been charged yet, there was nothing that he had done wrong. He had been faithful. He had only been in town for a few days, so he couldn't have caused much of a stir. He came. He was spending a lot of his time at the temple, being cleansed because of his. It was a 7-day period where he did some offerings for the end of his Nazarite vow. So there was no evidence of anything. So an acquittal, if even a charge was brought, an acquittal was certain. And his opposition couldn't handle that, so they went to drastic measures, right? Likely, these were Sicarii zealots, the same assassins who we heard about last time, and they were the ones who had assassinated the high priest recently, too. So the Sicarii zealots, they were at war with Rome at this time. They considered disciples of Yeshua as opponents to their cause. They nurtured xenophobic hatred toward Gentiles, and they despised Paul's Roman citizenship. So everything about Paul was something that they hated. But they shared this hatred with another group. And we'll see here in a minute. Okay, so these 42 Jews, these were the Sicarii assassins. So they say, "I will not eat or drink until they had killed Paul." So this is not like when we say, "I will not rest until this is done," right? Clearly, you're going to go to bed tonight and get some sleep, but you're not going to rest. You're not going to have any fun time, right? That's not this. This is a vow. They're saying, "I will not eat or drink." That means they are not going to eat or drink until this is done. Did it happen? No, they failed, right? But just understand that this vow dictated adherence to it. They were serious men.
That's a silly oath to make, since your chances of success dramatically decrease as dehydration is.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, honestly, that is. But it is dramatic, but it's also, they were probably very good at what they did and did not expect the kind of response from Claudius Lysias and his massive armed force that he would employ to protect this man. That probably didn't come into their understanding. Claudius Lysias was the unknown factor to them. They couldn't count on what he was going to do, and that he was going to be someone who had a profound respect for civil law, that he was going to do whatever it took any measure to protect this Roman citizen. So he had a respect for Roman citizenship, which I think, this is a fascinating point. It took a Roman commander who had a profound respect for executing proper civil law to protect a man who should have been under the protection of the men who are about the law, right? There's this contrast here. And after this point, Paul may have said, for your loving kindness is everlasting. Like, Claudius Lysias is my savior in this. Like, and he's protected, God has protected me with a mighty hand in all of these troops and horses and all this kind of stuff. So it's, but I would think that the Sicarii were so confident in their ability to do this, because they did it secretly. It was just, it was covert, stealth. It was all those
little knives, daggers that they could hide within their clothing. And they were hyper-religious.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they weren't the lost sheep in Israel, not following Torah. I mean, they blended in Jerusalem, so to say.
Yeah, okay, verse 13. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. So that's why I said 42. I'm not sure. They came to the chief priests, so this is the Sadducees, and the elders, but I would say and the sympathetic elders. So they didn't come to the council. They came to certain people on the council and said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you and the rest of the council notify the commander, this is Claudius Lysias, to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we for our part are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. The zealots hated Rome, but the Sadducees were all about appeasing Rome. But at this moment, Paul was a bigger problem for both of them, and it was worth teaming up. It was an unholy alliance, you could say. It solved some problems for both of them. And Ananias had the Sicarii, again, to thank for the assassination of his predecessor, his rival, Jonathan. Okay, moving on. Verse 16, and I'm going to read through a lot of this here. 23:16. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. His nephew was a Pharisee and would have been privy to some conversations, but he was around. You know, like, kids are around. We have our kids around. Like, it's just that they're going to hear of our plots today, and they may go warn their uncle. So. Verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this man, this young man, to the commander, this is Claudius, for he has something to report to him. So he took him and led him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you. The commander, Claudius Lysias, took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, and so Claudius, we're seeing again, he is wanting to do the right thing. He's wanting to do something to protect this prisoner, even though he may not agree with him. He may think he's a different kind of human being. Doesn't matter. He is about respecting the civil law and making sure things are done right. He has someone who has a lead on something. He takes them. He's to the side. He's like, what do you got? What's important? And he said, this is his nephew, Paul's nephew. The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they were going to inquire something more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them. For more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. So the commander, Claudius, let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one that you have notified me of these things. Don't tell anybody. Remember, there's no charges brought against Paul. That there's even an assassination plot for someone who there's no charges against signals to Claudius something much more heinous is going on here, and I need more help. This could have turned out very bad for Claudius, who, again, was the commander of the Fortress Antonia. He had a lot at stake. He was, imagine the president of the United States has come into town and you're in charge of security for the arena and you hear of something going on that's not related to that, but that could just blow up. You've got to deal with it, and you've got to deal with it fast, swiftly, with a lot of force. Just like, figure this out. Let's get rid of this thing so that nothing bad happens. So a lot was on the line for Claudius. Verse 23, and he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night. So the warning about the assassination plot was likely going to be happening during the day. He was going to be brought to the council during the day. So these Sicarii were planning for a daytime ambush and assassination. Claudius, though, wanted him to do this at night, the third hour of the night, which is about 9 p.m. 9 p.m., so after sunset. This is the night before. Get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. Lysias knew that 42 Sicarii, I mean, one assassin is one too many, but 42 of these fellows is a considerable force, and they could very easily muster a larger force if needed. So Lysias' response by leaving earlier in secrecy with 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen was the appropriate response. This was not an overreaction. This was, let's deal with this. And it wasn't even all of his forces. He was in charge of quite a number of people. We don't know exactly how many, but quite a number of soldiers. Verse 24. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form. Here's the letter. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews, which isn't true, a mob attacked him. He wasn't arrested by the Jews. And was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. This is an inversion of what happened. He acted before he knew of Paul's Roman citizenship. He was protecting himself in this by not admitting that he had inappropriately treated a Roman citizen. He also didn't want to express to the governor that there was any kind of riot or attack at all. He made out that the Jews arrested him, that it was peaceful. He was arrested, but I rescued him, having learned he was a Roman. So he's twisting the account so that he doesn't look bad, but it's still rather truthful, and it helps Paul's case, so it's fine. 28, and wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. He also doesn't mention the uproar at the council either, the chaos that was there, because he doesn't want his boss to know that any kind of chaos or uproar was happening under his watch. So he omits that and only shares with him that, oh yes, this was better. I recognize this. I took him. There was a plot. It was all very well done. Good for me, right? Verse 31. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. So obviously the 42 zealots had failed, these Sicarii, And they were probably hungry and thirsty. And they would die of starvation or thirst if they hadn't found a sympathetic rabbinic court to annul their vows, which is what they would have had to do, because they were ultra religious, super religious, and they were going to commit to this. So just so you know, that probably happened. But they didn't, we don't know what happened to them, obviously, but we know that this is probably what they had to do in order to survive. Verse 32, but the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with them, or on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, Felix, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. This was atypical. Well, I've only got 10 minutes. My goodness. This was atypical. He would have normally sent Paul to his home province and have that governor deal with it, right? But he was taking a personal interest in this for whatever reason. Felix is like, you know what? I'm going to try this myself. Felix, it was a toxic, childish leader who terrorized his subjects. He was not about order. He was not about goodness. He wasn't as bad as a Caligula or Nero or whatever, but he was not a good dude. He married the daughter of Herod the Great. He was not a Jew. He married the daughter of Herod the Great after having employed a magician, and would you believe that magician was Elymas bar Yeshua, who we'd read about in Acts 13 when Paul goes to Cyprus. Most likely the same magician was the one who convinced Drusilla to leave her husband for Felix, and it caused a bit of an uproar in the Jewish community. They were not happy with that. Her marriage ended, and then she married Felix, so it all worked out for Felix because Drusilla was beautiful. Drusilla is a fascinating character here, too. She was famously beautiful, the youngest daughter of Agrippa II, whose beauty caused extreme jealousy and resentment in her older sister Bernice, who ruled the roost in their family household. Okay, so there was some resentment in the family because of her beauty. It was her beauty that caused Felix to want her so much that he employed a magician to convince her to leave her husband and all this stuff. So there's you know, soap opera to the max here. Drusilla was a disgraced Jewish former queen. Her former husband was Queen Azizus or something like that. She was a queen, a Jewish queen. And she shamed her family by having ruined her marriage and going marrying this Felix, a despicable non-Jew. It's probable that she requested her husband invite in Paul for conversation over the 2 years he was imprisoned in the Praetorium out of her desire to find grace and forgiveness. So we don't read about Drusilla being this horrible, wicked woman. She made some mistakes, and she was suffering for them. Her beauty, which was nothing that she chose, caused a lot of stress in her family. I can sympathize with that. Just kidding. So she's a fascinating character here. Okay, moving on. 24, verse 1. And I'll try to fly through this here. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. And after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, and all I'll say about Tertullus's testimony is that it is full of flattery and half-truths. Remember, they hated Felix. They hated Felix. Well, I didn't tell you that, so it's not to remember, but they hated Felix because Felix married the disgraced daughter of Herod Agrippa, a Jewish queen. Like this was scandalous in the Jewish community. So they hated Felix. He was a treacherous man, tortured his people, and yet they tell him here, oh, we have, you know, through you, we've attained much peace, and since your providence, reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this above. You are great and wonderful and mighty. We so thank you. They hated him, though, despite wanting to appease him. Like, this is what the Sadducees do. And you know what? Felix knew this. Felix knew that they hated him. He knew not to trust them. He knew that their tongue would be dripping with praise and just all this stuff. But he would have to do the work of trying to figure out, is there any truth in what they're saying? But he wasn't going to play the game, right? So they give their account, which frames everything that happened with Paul as an interest to Rome. They're saying he's a sectarian ringleader, like all this kind of stuff that's interest to you. So they're being smart and clever in how they present this argument. But because Felix is not quite so dumb, he wasn't born yesterday, he's not going to play the game. And instead of interacting with them, he just, when they're done, he gives the floor to Paul. It's like, okay, Paul, what do you have to say? I can imagine his eyes are rolling, you know. So, then Paul gives his defense. And the most important part, and this is the part that Felix probably already knew, is in verse 13 of 24. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. Felix knows they have no proof. There's no proof. None of the people who were there, who even accused him, are present. There's no way to prove a lot of the things. Paul mentions, like, it was just 12 days ago I arrived in Jerusalem. There's no way that all of these things could have happened in that time. I was coming with alms and offering. I was just being a good Jew. So Felix knows this. Felix has probably already made up his mind. He's not going to charge him. And in Paul's speech, Paul takes stabs at the Sadducees, right? Like he mentions the resurrection of the dead again. Twice he does that. And then we get down to verse 22. But Felix, having a more exact knowledge about the way, put them off. So he put the Sadducees off and Ananias off, saying, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will decide your case. Lysias the commander was not planning on coming down, nor did Felix send for him. He was just saying, okay, I'm going to stall this indefinitely because I have that power. This was a unique kind of court hearing where the onus was on the accuser to bring proof. Because Felix was doing this himself, that changed the format of the proceedings, and the accusers had to bring proof. Paul knew there was no proof. Neither did Felix. Felix knew there was no proof. So he was just putting them off. It's like, well, whenever Lysias comes down, we'll see what he has to say. He also knew that the Sadducees hated him. And so he could stall this. Then he goes, verse 23, then he goes and gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet have some freedom and not to prevent any of his friends ministering to him. Felix couldn't just let Paul go because that would curry disfavor with the Sanhedrin. So he was kind of in a unique position. And he couldn't convict him because there was no case against him. And he was a Roman citizen. There was no evidence. So it was just like, okay. So Felix, being still a despicable person, holds on to him as probably a bargaining chip. He's going to use Paul. Maybe he'll be useful to him down the road. He's an important person. I'll just hold on to him here. And under the guise of stalling and waiting for Claudius Lysias to come and finish up the proceedings, I'll just keep him here. Does that make sense? So he's kind of being a selfish jerk. but it wasn't all bad, right? Verse 24, but some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Messiah Yeshua. But as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. So Paul here was speaking to a Gentile. He was a Greek who was in a position of power. And in so doing, his choice of topics were righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come. That was the message that he felt was important for a Gentile ruler to understand. I believe he was also speaking directly to Drusilla. I believe that Drusilla was the one who was encouraging Felix to bring him in, to invite him in. Drusilla, who was Jewish, who had shamed her family, who was in this terrible situation. It was just like, it's a tragic story for her. She's wanting to find more about this. She may have even wanted some quick grace, easy forgiveness, something. So she even had probably had a messianic hope as well. She knew the story. She probably knew who he was, right? Of course she knew who he was. She was the son, the granddaughter of Herod the Great, the niece of the woman who had beheaded John the Baptist, all these things, right? Yeah, so it's in the family. She knows what's going on. Felix, however, found it all very distasteful. He just really did not like this. And so what's interesting is to picture the captive saying something to his captor that terrifies him. Verse 26, at the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given to him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. So he was just looking for some cash. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul imprisoned. Felix kept trying to get money from Paul and his friends to no avail. He stopped listening, probably, but Drusilla, I'm sure, was listening intently to every word. They ended up not listening to him, but they should have, because the end of the story for Felix and Drusilla, 2 years later, Felix was removed from office by Nero, and so he and Drusilla decided to maybe retire to the country. So they take up and they go and settle down in a nice seaside town called Pompeii. And we all know what happened in Pompeii around 76 AD, right? And this was in the 50s here that was happening. So they were probably there for a good bit and likely perished in the volcano eruption in Pompeii. So, okay. So there we have it. What is the one point I want to make here? Paul was certain in his walk that he had everything he needed to face whatever came his way. In the chaos of all this dramatic stuff that's happening with Ananias, Felix, Drusilla, Claudius Lysias, the Sicarii, all the stuff that's happening around, blah, 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 it's just like, it's loud, there's things crashing into each other, all these different fights and aggressors and antagonists and opponents, all this stuff going on around him. Paul was this straight line through, going through it, steady as he goes. Despite all the chaos and chaotic players around him, he was certain enough in his place with Yeshua before God that he could stand alone, defending himself before each and every court. He was his own lawyer in these things, too. He didn't have Tertullus, a well-known, expensive lawyer. It was just him. The Sanhedrin, in the last chapter, the last teaching. Felix, here. Next, it'll be Festus, and then Agrippa. He knew he had within him, through the Holy Spirit, all the patience, courage, peace, reason, love, clarity, focus, whatever he would need to face whatever he faced each day. It was an endless spring of those things that had been given to him through the Holy Spirit as he is seated to Messiah. We can be like Paul. He is a mere mortal, right? Seated firmly in Messiah, and walking with him, standing tall. I've been reading through this book recently by Watchman Nee, Sit, Walk, Stand. It's a very easy read, but it is dense. And it is basically a commentary on passages of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Paul loved the congregation of the Ephesians. In his letter to the Ephesians, you can tell he is so proud of them. They have been doing so well. There's nothing in that letter that displays a specific acute problem that they're having as a congregation, but all is general, universal things in which a body should do to be even better than it is. And they were doing well. They were firing on all cylinders. He loved them. Let me read Ephesians 5, 15 and 17. Therefore, be careful of your walk. And what is your walk? Your walk is how you do the Torah. Be careful of how you live out God's will. Not as unwise men, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are full of evil. Blah, chaos, all these things. He was right through. He was redeeming the time. He was following God's will. He was wise and not foolish. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. He knew God's will. He was seated firmly in Messiah. And because he had that and the Holy Spirit, he had access within him, just as you do, all of the character traits of God that you will need when God brings something your way. He's not going to test you or me and not have already given you what you need to face it. Yeah, right? That's so good. It is, there is nothing, we don't read, if we go back here, we don't read anything about the great effort Paul put forward. It was just, Paul said, Paul this. It was calm and steady. He trusted. He didn't have to try. He just had to trust that whatever he was facing, he would have what he needed, and that it wouldn't be of his own effort, of his own investment, of his own energy. It would be there, ready and accessible. Isn't that good?
It's timeless. It's so very, very interesting. We're looking at this and talking about this. I've been in a daily prayer group, international, since October 7th. And on a daily basis, we say, keep your eyes on Messiah and walk in the will of the Lord. If you know mm-hmm. who you have his purpose for you, mm-hmm. keep your eyes on Messiah, do what you've been told you need to be doing. And if you don't know, seek it out.
Yeah.
But that's the recipe
yeah.
for all of us.
I can add to that. I think a step of the recipe that you taught, that the Bible says the steps of a righteous person is ordered by the Lord.
Yeah. Mm.
So do everything that you mentioned mm-hmm. that God had told us to do. We'll walk that path of righteousness and have the courage and the bravery and the knowledge and understanding of what's going on around us.
Right. It's a paradigm shift. I don't know. We don't see the vast majority of the prayers Paul prayed as he was going through this experience. But I don't know if he, based on what he was writing in Ephesians, I'm going to make a presumption that he wasn't praying that God would give him the courage he needed, that he would give him the love he needed, give him the patience he needed. He believed it was already there. If we start our day, and he redeemed the time, he knew, he's like, I'm never going to get this day back. No matter what it is, this is a unique day that is there's only one of, and I'm redeeming this time. I'm going to do my best to follow God's will, and this will be the one time I get this day. Also, starting his day maybe with an understanding, I already have everything I need. It's already there. Like you said, God orders the steps of the righteous. If he orders the steps, he's not going to do that in not having given us what we need to face it. It's already there. If there's someone in your work or wherever that you don't know how to deal with, instead of praying, God, give me the patience, say, God, thank you for already giving me the patience. It's already there. All I have to go and do is do it. Just be there. Be the one who offers love. Be the one who offers grace. Be the one who forgives. Be the one who has the words that are necessary for that person to hear. Just trust. Trust that it's there and accessible. That is good. That's great news, I think.
He's imprisoned at this point.
He's imprisoned, yeah.
He doesn't have freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's as if he says, okay, Lord, if this is where I am today, this is where I'm supposed to be. Give me my walking orders.
Yeah.
You know, what divine appointments do we have on the book today?
Right. It's almost like you can do a reset. Oh. It's like okay, I'm in this chaotic situation. Just like okay. Here is my reality. Start from a place of knowing, okay, this was what God had for me, and he's also given me the tools I need to handle it. All right. All of a sudden, I've got the patience I need. All of a sudden, I've got the clarity and focus I need. It is a mind shift. And that's he talks about this in a couple ways in Ephesians, where it's just this different way of thinking about it and how you operate and how you walk. So that's the one lesson I could draw out of it. Mm-hmm. And we can talk more about this while we eat, but I'm just going to go ahead and pray and end the live stream. Father, we thank you so much for the example of Paul again and just his thorough and near perfect understanding of what it means to be walking out this life. And that he gave us such a great example. We thank you for Luke for having written all this down and so that we could read about it and learn from it all these many centuries later. We thank you so much for your will. We thank you for your spirit that you've placed in us, which helps us to access all of your divine attributes at any moment whenever we need it to face the things that you've ordained for us in our walk. We thank you so much. We praise you. We thank you especially for Yeshua, our master, our rabbi, our teacher, our king, our high priest, and all that he did for us so that we can be included in this grand story. And for Passover that's coming up, that is the beginning of this type of story of salvation, this pattern of salvation. We praise you today on this Shabbat, this very special Shabbat. And we just love you so much. Thank you. We praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen. Mm-hmm.